I will give a brief biography of myself. I'm a bit of a freak about starting on time, so I thought there would be these few minutes at the beginning where there are still people coming in. I didn't realize that the technology was going to give us so many problems. So I am going to say a little bit about myself. A lot of what I'm going to be saying tonight is about the thought of Noam Chomsky as I understand it. And I would say that Chomsky hasn't just... it would be fair to say Chomsky has formed my thinking on a whole range of intellectual issues and moral issues, political issues. So it's not just that I've been influenced. I'd say he's, to the extent that I've understood it, Chomsky's ideas and positions have formed my own. Someone else who's been very influential for me as a writer and journalist is a guy called I.F. Stone, who was a journalist in the starting off in the 30s, and he was an independent journalist, and he had his own paper in Washington, D.C. called I.F. Stone's Weekly, which was a very powerful alternative voice, critical voice, even during the McCarthy years, and was very influential in the social movements of the 60s and 70s and so on. Well, he stopped in the 70s. One of the interesting things about I.F. Stone is that as soon as he stopped producing his weekly magazine, he kind of became a national treasure. As soon as he was tame, in other words, as soon as he wasn't an active part of the movements, then all the liberals started going on about how wonderful he was, and the Nation magazine, which had been studiously ignoring him, suddenly was saying what a great newspaper journalist he was. And there's a great website actually on available now online where you can read a lot of his material. And it's all part of the, isn't I.F. Stone great? But that only started after he stopped being a threat, after he stopped being an active independent journalist. So I was very influenced, and in 1991 I copied I.F. Stone for 6 months, writing a weekly magazine, which was a complete rip-off, except I couldn't write as well as him. But that was covering the Gulf War of 1991 and the aftermath until July or so. I also produced other magazines, pamphlets, including the unforgettable Britain, Maastricht and the Bomb, about the common foreign and security policy of the European Union. I've written some books as well. I'm not a postmodernist. I'm not into highly theoretical language. I'm not into too many syllables, a multi-syllabic discourse. I didn't call my first book Hegemony, Modularity and Agency, for example, which I could have done. I called it Chomsky's Politics, which is rather unimaginative and unpoetic. I didn't call my last book, you can't read it properly because of the font thing. I didn't call my last book Western Jihadism, Alienation, Aggression and Apoptosis, though I could have done. I called it 7/7 London Bombings, Islam and the Iraq War. It wasn't until I was putting together that slide, actually, that I found out how to pronounce apoptosis. That was a little leap forward for me in my learning. There is this other side of me, which is that I'm also an activist. This is me making my own contribution to the debate around the run-up to the attack on Fallujah in November 2004. And as a result of that, it turns out that the Portland stone, which the Foreign Office is made out of, is quite expensive to clean. And so because I didn't pay £2,000 to clean it up, I went to Lewis Prison. I've also been in Pentonville and Wandsworth and Wormwood Scrubs. So now I'm a co-editor of Peace News. Peace News has got two functions, broadly speaking. One is to report the bad things that are happening, which maybe aren't getting as much attention as they should, or to bring new aspects of them to light. And the other is to report and support people who are doing constructive things for peace. So that's my background. That was supposed to be the first few minutes while there are still people filtering in. So I'm going to try and say something about the media and the Chomsky's analysis of the media. But it starts off with the question that's raised at the beginning, which is about the responsibility of intellectuals. Chomsky's first major essay was called The Responsibility of Intellectuals, and it's really what most of his work centers around. Chomsky in that essay starts off by referring to some articles by Dwight MacDonald at the time of the Second World War. And Dwight MacDonald, who was a political literary critic in the US, he started off asking questions about to what extent the people of Japan and Germany bore responsibility for the crimes of the German and Japanese states during the Second World War. And as Chomsky says, well, very rapidly Dwight MacDonald turned that around and said, well, to what extent are the crimes of the US and Britain, this is the survivor of Hiroshima, are they the responsibility of us, ordinary people in Britain and the United States? You may not know, actually, that due to the Quebec Agreement, by which Britain shared nuclear technology with the US, Britain was consulted on the decision to drop the bomb, and Churchill had to give his say-so, which he did. So Britain participated in the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To what extent were the ordinary people of Britain and the US responsible for the crimes of the Britain and US in the war? And Chomsky said, well, there is a lot to say about the responsibility of peoples for their governments, and obviously the responsibility varies in relation to what kind of social setup you have, but intellectuals have specific and greater responsibilities. Was there anyone who came to my talk at Shared Planet? Yes, all right, okay. Last time I was in a hurry, and the first picture that comes up when you Google image intellectual is this white guy sitting with a book. So I said I apologized to everybody, and I went away and got another picture. That's actually a picture of Bob Moses of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was one of the cutting-edge civil rights groups during the 1960s in the US. Anyway, Chomsky said, and you know, they were a group of committed students, committed intellectuals, who went and lived amongst the poorest African Americans in Mississippi and other places, and helped to organize their communities to overthrow white supremacy. Anyway, what Chomsky says is that intellectuals have greater responsibilities than peoples, because they, in a society where you've got political liberty and where intellectuals have got resources such as libraries and so on, and where they have freedom of expression, they have, intellectuals have opportunities, and they have the, actually Hilary Wainwright kind of made a remark about this in the tail end of her thing about saying leisure is a very important privilege. Intellectuals have leisure, facilities, and the training to pierce through the class interest and state propaganda, the distortions through which events are relayed to us. Now, what I'm going to be talking about is largely about the media, but what Chomsky says is that his topic is really the intellectual culture in general. So it applies as much to academia as it does to the New York Times or anything like that. In the same way that, for those of you who know about his work in linguistics, his work in linguistics is really about cognitive psychology. It isn't just about linguistics. So in the same way, the media is a point of entry into the topic, giving insights, rather than him just being interested in the media per se. And so his remarks apply to the intellectual culture generally. Okay. This is a story that appeared in The Observer last year, and this is the headline. What it was reporting was an estimate by the polling agency ORB, who are a mainstream pollster. They do polls for Countryside Agency, they do polls for National Heritage. They've done a whole bunch of polls inside Iraq, which have been reported by the mainstream papers about attitudes towards the occupation and so on. You know, they're a mainstream polling agency. And last September, they published a poll where they'd gone to Iraq and they'd asked about 800 households, how many members of your household, people who live under your roof, have died violently since the invasion. And based on that, they made an estimate of how many people had been killed violently since the invasion, which, given that the rate of violent death in the years preceding the invasion was pretty much nil. That was a kind of rough estimate of how many people had been killed violently during the occupation. And their estimate was, on the basis of that survey, was about 1.2 million Iraqis had died violently. How many people here knew about this estimate of last September? Stick your hand up. Okay. I think that's about a quarter of the people here, which I would say is pretty high. You must have a very good Peace Movement magazine, I guess, or something like that. What happened was that the that estimate, that ORB estimate, was reported. This Observer story, and it had, I think, 42 seconds on Newsnight, and that was the extent of the coverage. We in Peace News, we just did a little thing which we nominated the two most censored stories of 2008. And this is one of them as well, because what happened was that in January, ORB published a new estimate, because the last one had been most 800 mostly urban households, and they went to 600 rural households. So they had a larger sample, therefore it should be more accurate, and so on. And they revised their estimate downwards to just over 1 million Iraqis dying a violent death since the invasion. As far as I know, and I've looked pretty carefully, there is nothing, there is no report of that stronger estimate in any British newspaper. The only report you'll find is one of the reviews editors of Peace News writing a letter to complain about this to The Guardian, the fact that no one had reported it. And I think that's the only thing you'll find in the papers in Britain. I may be wrong, but I think it's zero. So I think one can say two things. One can say, A, if someone asks, was this estimate, 1.2 million estimate, reported in the British media? You can say, yes, it was reported. Here's the evidence. If you ask, was this estimate effectively censored? I think you would say, yes, it was effectively censored. And some of the techniques of the propaganda system are evident in this story as well. Now, one of the things that you'll notice about it is that the very last word in the headline is 1.2 million. Now, what that is signalling is that it's the least important part of the story. And in fact, if you read quickly, you might not even kind of notice it, that it's saying 1.2 million. It could very easily have gone the other way, you know. 1.2 million dead in Iraq, as Greenspan admits, it's put that way, and the estimate, the ORB estimate, is the subject of the second half of the story, the highlighted section. Now, if you read the story, which I recommend you doing, you will find that it's actually a pretty well-written story. It's got a lot of important information in it. For example, the very last line, and often, actually, the penultimate and last paragraphs of a newspaper story have got the most useful information in them, I find. The last paragraph tells you that an MOD official said that the methodology used for the Lancet estimate a few years ago, there are two estimates, 2004-2005, of the number of Iraqis who died was robust and pretty near the state of the art, roughly summarising what it says there. So what the story does by the placement is it tells you that this isn't very important. What we did was we put it on the front page and we asked a US journalist student to look into it. She was very upset by trying to get journalists on news desks to explain why they hadn't covered it, or in the Observer's case, why they'd covered it the way they did. They just effectively hung up on her and wouldn't respond to her. So she found that quite upsetting and quite disillusioning about the job that she wants to go into. So one of the ways in which the free media, and they are free of government control very largely, affects how we receive information is placement. Another thing is tone. If you read that second half of the story, you'll find it is a clinical and very muted description of a number of facts, which are important. But if you were reading a story in The Guardian about, let's say, the deaths of Jewish citizens of Israel who were being killed by Qassam rockets, you wouldn't find simply a recitation of facts. You would have interviews with relatives, you would have politicians saying something strong about it, you would have an emotional intensity about this loss of life or injury. And I think that's very appropriate. If someone's getting hurt like that, it's very appropriate that there should be some emotional intensity around it. However, that's not what we find with this estimate of 1.2 million people dying in Iraq, not a few people dying in a border town in Israel. No one's quoted, no one's outraged, it's very calm. So that's another thing, another way in which information is presented to us in a way that helps to effectively censor things. Another thing is frequency. Now, in this case, the lower image is a bit misleading because there's only one blip, actually. It's not that there's two peaks. There's only one momentary notice of this story, and that's been the case with a number of very important bits of information which have been reported in the media, but which have been reported for an instant and then forgotten. And an example of that would be in relation to Iran. Now, everyone knows that one of the most serious international crises that there may be in the next year or so may be about Iran and Iran's nuclear program. And the way that it's presented is that Iran is intransigent, Iran is irrational, Iran is confrontational, and Iran is the blockage, and these people from the EU keep trying to talk to them, not getting anywhere. People from the UK, you know, people keep trying to talk to the Iranians, and they don't make any headway. That's the way it's presented. The problem with that picture is that earlier this year, to the amazement of a lot of people, Iran put forward a proposal that its uranium enrichment facilities, which are the things that people are really worried about, which could be used, in theory, to create weapons-grade uranium, to put them under international controls. So it would be a consortium of French, German, Iranian government management. There would be internationals at every stage of the process. That was the proposal which they were responding to. And so if that had been accepted, there would be no way for Iran to enrich to weapons-grade uranium. And if Iran ejected everybody, and that would be a signal that they were probably had bad intentions at a point where they hadn't managed to enrich any weapons-grade uranium at that point. So that was a very important initiative. But if you go back and look through the reporting the rest of the summer, the EU goes and talks to them, etc., etc. There's a lot of coverage about the failure of the EU mission to get anywhere with these Iranians. But you will not find any further mention after the May the 13th, when this came out. Well, that's when they told Ban Ki-moon about it. The actual reporting was a little bit later. That's when they made this proposal. But after that first blip in May, throughout June, July, August, when there's all of this kerfuffle going on, negotiating kerfuffle, there's no mention of it. And I went back and looked at The Independent, and there's lots of reporting about how the Iranians are not responding, and there's no mention about this consortium, international consortium proposal they made. So frequency is a very important part of how the system works. Okay, now we're going to do a little exercise together, which is another feature of the way that the media behaves is not just in how it relays what's going on elsewhere, but also how it relays us to ourselves. Now, these are questions from a poll which was published last March 2007. And so I'm going to show you some questions which were which were asked in the poll, which is conducted by the Daily Telegraph. I'm not a phenomenally left-wing paper. And so this one was actually, this one actually had a question beforehand, which was to do with, you know, government. So people in the military say that we're overstretched. Do you think that we are or not? Which wasn't very relevant to me. So there were four groups in the 30 to 40 and two in the 20 to 30 who probably all of those are in the perceptive category of being able to see what the general opinion is, unless you were trying to guess the opinion of Telegraph readers, in which case you're way off base. But of the general population, what that shows is that it's basically 2-1 against. Now, what all of those things add up to, and I think the one that... I think this is the most interesting in the sense that it's we should reduce our commitment, spend less, and not seek to have as much military influence as the world we have now. 2/3 of people in Britain thinking that. That's not the image that comes across in the mass media of the British people. That's not the way it's presented. And this is 2007. This is before credit crunch. It's got nothing to do with pressure on government finances. And in fact, if you go back through the polls, what you find is that there is a stable plurality or majority in favour of acting like a medium-sized European state and not trying to be a great power. And there are polls going way back over the last 30 years or so which indicate that that's how the British people feel. That's been not exactly a national consensus, but a majority or plurality view that Britain shouldn't try to be a great power, but nevertheless that's what the government does. And one of the ways that the government gets away with it is because we do not understand what our own opinion is, so to speak, as a society. Okay, here was another question that was asked, which was about Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, does anyone have any view about, do they think that the results are going to be different for Iraq and Afghanistan? Is there anyone who thinks they will be different, significantly different? Okay, why do you think they'll be significantly different?
Public opinion tends to be more in favour of Afghanistan than Iraq. Is seen as slightly more justified.
Okay, anyone else feel that way? Okay, anyone feel that they will be the same, roughly speaking? Yeah, why do you think they'll be the same?
I don't think people, like, if they're against putting forces out there, they'll be against it, period, not, like, in one country against the other.
Okay, well... Okay, so what we're going to find out now is A, the gap, and B, also the strength of feeling about bringing them home soon. And the gap is pretty moderate, so you know, you're both kind of right in the sense that they should be brought home soon, only a 6% gap on that. That's not enormous. There is a gap, so that people do feel differently, but it's not gigantic. And on both of them, it's a majority. Which also isn't the way, that's my perception, isn't the way that British public opinion is presented to us, I think, about this. Anyone disagree with that? Anyone think that British public opinion is presented to us as a majority? It's like 1.5 times as many people against the wars as in favour of them. Anyone think that... Oh, hey, okay, yep.
Well, I mean, I think it was fairly clear that people were against Iraq.
Yeah, but right now, in the media, do you think the way that the public opinion is presented, public opinion in Britain is presented, do you think it's presented as a massively anti-both wars?
No, I wouldn't say that it's presented as pro-war, either. It's just kind of ignored.
Okay, fair point. Okay, this is a poll that just got published last week, I think, by... the BBC. Is there anyone who knew about this poll result? Stick your hand up if you knew about it before tonight. Okay, zero hands I saw. That was a BBC poll which was conducted for a debate that there was on Radio 4 about withdrawal from Afghanistan. The BBC put together a balanced panel, which is to say they had seven people who were in favor of the war and one person who was against the war. And at the same time, they published this poll, which showed that, what is it? It's like three times the people nearly think that British troops should be withdrawn as think that they shouldn't be withdrawn. And I think this received a mention in some newspapers. I think that Financial Times, as usual, had probably had the best coverage of it. But all of these are about how there's a gap between how things are presented to us about ourselves and the evidence as it exists. And obviously there are problems with polls, but I think these are plausible polls. They're in line with other data that we've got, and I see no reason to doubt them. What's happening is that this poll appears, is done. It costs a hell of a lot of money to do. The BBC does this poll. It's staging a radio debate. It does not particularly highlight this in its news reporting itself, and the rest of the media chooses to report it in the most muted terms possible. But what it shows is that just as the British government is trying to prepare itself for being asked to escalate its presence in Afghanistan massively by Barack Obama, the British people are totally against the presence, never mind escalation. So that should be kind of newsworthy. And according to normal news values, it should be reported, at least. You know, people may disagree with what the general public thinks, but it's not there. I've been going on for quite a long time now, and I've only just come to the propaganda model. So I'm going to try and be very brief about this section. There's a lot more stuff that I was going to talk about, and then I'm trying to wind it up in maybe 10 minutes. There's a difference between the Edward Herman Chomsky model of the propaganda system, the propaganda model, as depicted in this book, Manufacturing Consent. There's a difference between this model and the way that Noam Chomsky writes about the propaganda system and the propaganda model. And I'll just outline briefly Edward Herman's description of it, which Noam Chomsky is part of this book, but he is not the initiator of this model. So Edward Herman says there's five filters in the mass media in the West. One of those is capital costs. If you're going to start up as a broadcaster, or if you're going to start a national newspaper, you've got to make a massive investment to start up, which means either you've got to be very rich, or you've got to persuade a bunch of people who are very rich to back you. So one of the filters is very rich people have to be in favor of whatever it is you're doing. Another thing is what he calls the advertising license. When you and I buy a newspaper, what we think we're doing is we're handing over money, and in return, we are buying information and views. That's not what's happening. If you look at the balance sheets of newspapers, what you find is that 60-70% of their revenue doesn't come from us handing money over at the counter. It comes from advertising. So just think about that for a moment. The main customer of a newspaper is not you and me at the newsagent. It is a corporation taking out, or it's a bunch of corporations taking out advertising. What's actually happening in the transaction is not that you and I are buying news and information. What's happening is that a corporation is paying a newspaper to rent some of our attention, some of our mental space. Space on the page is our eyeball attention. That's the main thing that's going on financially. 60-70% of the money, and therefore 60-70% of the viability of a paper, comes from advertising. If you cut down on the advertising, you're less able to pay the highest salaries for columnists, you're less able to have the best quality printing and so on. You lose the edge, competitive edge, in a whole bunch of ways. So the advertising License is how it's being described. The reason why I've put up Auto Trader is that you may or may not know that the Guardian and Observer group, who most of their revenue as newspapers, Guardian and Observer, comes from advertising, they make losses every year. So I think last year they lost £14 million, for example. They keep going because they're part of a larger Guardian media group. And the main profit centre in the Guardian media group is Auto Trader. So when you read George Monbiot writing about climate change and how we've got to fight it and so on in the Guardian, which, you know, I fully support George Monbiot, I think he's a great guy and so on, but he is able to do that because the Guardian is able to keep going because of car advertising. And that's where the money that keeps the Guardian Observer going is. So there's the advertising license. There's simple kind of sourcing subsidy from newsmakers, which is to say that when a corporation or a government ministry puts on a press conference, makes facilities available for the media, or provides pre-digested news in a press release and so on, you know, all of that takes money and effort. And obviously the bigger you are, the richer you are, the more you can subsidize the media by providing these kinds of facilities. Another thing that influences what happens in the media is what Herman calls flack, which is to say, when something happens that you don't like, you protest about it, you create trouble. And obviously, the richer you are, and more powerful you are, the more flack you can fire, the more pressure you can put on someone, a media outlet, for doing something that you don't like them doing. And obviously, for an advertiser, one of the ways in which they can do that is by withdrawing their advertising. Someone said to me, and I don't know to what extent this is based in fact, but it's an idea worth thinking about. I was raising the question about, you may sometimes notice that there are like full-page adverts for Chorus, you know, British Steel or somebody like that, and you think, well, not a lot of readers of The Independent actually buy a lot of steel or, you know, stuff like that. You know, why do they do that? Why do some of these people who are not retail companies take out this advertising? Well, someone said to me, I don't know to what extent it's true, that a lot of that is insurance. So if a newspaper is expecting a certain amount of advertising from your account, then it's going to be very careful if it prints something which hurts your image. It's going to be more cautious about that, because the first thing that you're going to do is you say, well, you hurt me, I'm not going to advertise on you. So I don't know to what extent that's true, but that kind of illustrates how some of the dynamics work, where you wouldn't necessarily need to ever say anything to anybody at that newspaper. You are just placing a steady supply of advertising with them, and that's an important part of their revenue. So the fifth element in Herman's model is ideology. In this book, he calls anti-communism, obviously before the collapse of the Soviet Union. But probably it would be more accurate to talk about it as, in the United States, as a particular state capitalist ideology, of which the basic principle is that what the government is doing is well-intentioned. It may be in error, it may be, you know, there may be problems in implementation or so on, but the basic assumption is the intention is good, the cause is noble, but there may be problems along the way, or there may be some evil person who has seized the reins of power, like President Nixon, who you need to get rid of. But basically, the state is well-intentioned. Now, Chomsky doesn't use the five filters for doing his own analysis, and his focus is less on the corporate dynamics, the oligopoly in the media market, increasing concentration, and that kind of macro level. What Chomsky talks about much more is the individual, the individual academic, the individual journalist, and the decisions that you make as an individual. And one of the things that he does talk about a lot is about the permitted spectrum of opinion within the media. Now, within the media, the self-perception is that the media are committed to truth and democracy and justice, and that some elements of the media, the liberal media, are just too committed to those things. They're too wild, you know, they're destructive. And I think that was what John Lloyd was writing about a little bit in his book, What Have the Media Done to Our Society, or something like that. He wrote a very silly book a few years ago with that title. And some people say, you know, the age of deference is over, but the media are too corrosive, they're too anti. And we've got to get back to a balance. So that is the self-perception of people within the media, and one can say something analogous about academia as well. However, what Chomsky says is, I actually like doing this, I did, whoops. What Chomsky talks about a lot is the permitted spectrum of opinion within the mass media. And what his contention is that actually there are quite narrow limits on the permitted spectrum of opinion. He is writing about the US, which is narrower than the UK. But his contention is that the permitted spectrum is basically all within that boundary at the edge there of service to power. So the perception is of service to truth and freedom, but the reality is service to power. And he's got a whole load of examples, and you know, I've kind of ruined things by taking too long on the other stuff, so people can ask about it and we can discuss it. And what Chomsky calls that thing about liberal self-perception is feigned dissent, which is to say that the people who think that they are dissident and who are treated as dissident within the mainstream media, but who aren't. So if we take the Vietnam War, this is from Grosvenor Square, 1968. This is the classic example which Chomsky started off with. Forgive me if you're familiar with it. This is Arthur Schlesinger, the historian and member of the Kennedy administration, who was a noted anti-war figure within the mainstream during the Vietnam War. And that is Joseph Alsop, who was a noted hawk and pro-war person. So the debate within the mainstream went from, roughly speaking, Arthur Schlesinger to Joseph Alsop. Arthur Schlesinger was against the war, and Joseph Alsop was in favour of the war. However, when Arthur Schlesinger said he was against the war, Joseph Alsop said, we should be in this war, and we will win this war. And Arthur Schlesinger said, we shouldn't be in this war, but... So the difference between them was tactical. Joseph Alsop thought the US could win and would win in Vietnam, and that's why he was in favour of it. Arthur Schlesinger thought that we weren't going to win, the US. The US wasn't going to win in Vietnam, and therefore we should stop. The costs were too high. It was a mistake. So that wasn't a moral objection or a legal objection, it was a tactical disagreement. And both of these guys agreed on the fundamental principle that the United States, out of all the countries in the world, should have the right to restructure any society that it chose by force at the time of its own choosing. That the United States should be able to invade and reorder societies when it wanted to, when it thought it was right. What they differed on was whether this was a cost-effective use of US power. Joseph Alsop thought they were going to win, Arthur Schlesinger thought it was going to cost too much, and that they weren't going to win. So that's them both at the correct end of the spectrum. So what Chomsky's saying is that the debate is all taking place at that end of the spectrum. And the beauty of the system is that the more the debate rages, the more fiercely people engage in that debate, the more deeply the underlying assumption is driven home, which is to say, we all agree that we should be allowed to do this when we can win, when the costs are not too high. And what the Arthur Schlesinger type person does is the most important part of the system, because what they signify is this far and no further. If you go beyond this position in your dissidence, you are crazy. You are irrational. You are not fit to have a discussion with. You are embarrassing. You are unintelligible. And that is the function of the mainstream liberal. That is the function of someone who is knowingly or unknowingly engaging in feigned dissent. What Chomsky says is that the smart people know what they're doing, but most of them aren't that smart. They just do what they believe in. And so a columnist, a liberal columnist, can say completely honestly, no one ever tells me what to write. I write whatever I like. And Chomsky says, yes, that's absolutely true. I don't doubt it for a moment. But the reason why you have been selected to be a columnist is because they know that you're a safe pair of hands. You have been trained, and this goes for pretty much all of us in this room, I should think, including myself, you've been trained since you were an infant through your schooling process to be obedient. That's what a lot of school is about. A lot of school is about doing stupid things that you're told you should do and not making too much of a fuss about it. And that's how you get through. That's how you get to be, you know, not kicked out of school for being disruptive. That's how you get to pass exams, by learning the stupid stuff that, you know, no one needs to know, but you're told you need to learn it to pass the exam, and you're obedient. That's what I did. So the whole of the process of schooling, university and so on, and into work, is selecting for conformism. And the people who rise to the top, very often, generally speaking, have become safe. You don't need to tell them what to write because they've internalized it. And that's Chomsky's main point, is that the way that the propaganda system works is not by someone in Whitehall sending out a directive. Do not report the ORB estimate. Don't tell anyone about that 1.2 million thing. It's not Rupert Murdoch sending out a memo saying, stop everyone, you know. Don't mention the BBC 68% won us out of Afghanistan thing. That's not how the system works. The system is decentralized. It's a free market. It's a guided free market in that the people who are rich are the ones who are hiring. So it's only if you filter through their selection process that they're going to hire you and promote you. If you get your foot in the door and you're in a newsroom and you want to cover stories which harm the interests which should be protected, you don't go anywhere. You don't get promoted. You end up forever sitting outside the courtroom in the courthouse, or on the police beat, or the low-ranking stuff. Or in academia, you end up in some, you know, college that isn't terribly prestigious on without much prospects, because you're looking at the wrong stuff and you're doing the wrong things. No one has to say to you, look, this is what you're supposed to focus on. You absorb it by osmosis. You internalize it from your environment. I did an economics degree. I think that's a lot of what an economics degree is about, is it's about getting people to internalize basically religious doctrines, as far as I can make out, and for that to become your way of thinking. And I think that's what that's what Chomsky says is happens in the newsroom and so on. You learn news values. 68% of Britain's thinking we should get out of Afghanistan is news. 1.2 million people dying in Iraq. Maybe the poll is wrong, but the fact that someone's come up with that estimate, that's news. That should be news values. But that's not what news values is when you learn it in the newsroom. What you learn in the newsroom is there are some topics you can deal with and some topics you steer around. And it's that internalized sense of political correctness, as Chomsky describes it, that is the most important part of the propaganda system. And what's underneath that, coming back to the responsibility of intellectuals, is that the cost of breaking from that is significant in terms of loss of career opportunities, in terms of people looking at you funny and thinking that you're crazy and stupid and so on, in terms of people vilifying you and saying hateful things about you, which are lies, but because you're disturbing the setup. I mean, the vilification of Chomsky is just, you know, when you look into it, the accusations which have been made against him with no basis whatsoever is horrifying. So there are costs involved in breaking with that path. And what it boils down to is, Chomsky never says this, but this is the import of what he's saying, I think, is what price are you willing to put on your integrity? And that's what it boils down to for every one of us. So I'm going to call it quits at that point, and we'll go to the next phase of the evening. Thank you.